able to do what he done. I mean, the boys were so innocent, so small. I want him dead, I want him to do his time and die the last day, so that he never leaves prison. When Aaron was with us, for the first 4 weeks, there was no arguments between me and him. And I always remember that, the perfect time when he was with us. And then things started to go strange, go wrong. It was a weekend, and it was his shot to get up with him. And he would come running in and say he's not breathing. He's gone blue. We got him to hospital. We were in about 5-6 days. So many tests, and I stayed in with him. So many different tests every single day. Horrible tests. To be back to normal again, could have been a virus, could have been, they weren't sure. Got him back home. And by Friday, happened again. When the ambulance came, he would sit up in the front. The ambulance driver would always say, do you want to sit up in the front? Because I was in the back with him. But he enjoyed the idea of sitting up in the front when the lights were gone. I'd always remember that he'd done that. Oh, he liked to sit up in front. Then he would tell everybody, I sat up in the front of the ambulance.
One particular form of child abuse, which we call Munchausen syndrome by proxy, is where the child is presented as ill when they're not, and the illness is often caused by the parent in order to get attention for themselves. And this would have involved being transported by ambulance and the excitement of that, having the attention of the most senior medical staff looking and caring for your child, negotiating with you about the child's care, asking you questions about yourself and the child. All this attention is very reinforcing for the behaviour of abusing the child again to get the attention again.
So only a few days we had him home and it started again. Why is this happening again? He was 3 weeks old and happened. Got him in the hospital and more tests. And then he was out a few days later. When we were at the hospital and we were all sitting round and he's on my knee and he was hooked up to the machine. And then the doctor came in and says, he's deteriorating, we're not going to get him back.
Darren, Mark and I, we went outside and Darren's standing, he's kind of having his fag and smoking away. Fuck's sake, he says, that means now Jacob's dead, my blue money's going to go back down. And I just remember thinking how bloody horrible, and I walked away absolutely horrified, I couldn't even stand any longer.
Medical staff, nursing staff in particular, noticed from the child's file that there had been a death of an earlier sibling, the younger brother Aaron. Similarities, striking similarities in terms of the presentation of both those cases, in particular that both children had suffered from these unexplained breathing difficulties, where the child apparently, for no known medical reason, stops breathing. Karen Jenkinson appeared to be cooperative, willing to help. He came to the police office of his own volition. And Darren thought that he would be able to persuade the police on this occasion that this death was natural causes, as he had managed to do on the first occasion in 1995. And I asked him outright, is there something you're not telling us? He nodded his head. And he then goes on to make a confession to killing both his children. It was chilling. This was not a confession, if you like, from someone who was absolutely devastated. Because the thing that struck me was, he seemed to be able to tell the circumstances leading up to the death of the two children in a rather matter-of-fact way. And you know, as a police officer, I was surprised that he was able to be quite so matter-of-fact, quite so calm about it. Frankly, as a parent, I was horrified. He described the actions that he took by taking the infant's bibs and moulding, and that's his word, moulding the infant's bibs around the children's nose and mouth. And through that process, that was what was causing the obstruction to the upper airway of the children and leading to these unexplained breathing difficulties. And ultimately, that is what killed his first son and also his second.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
Today's episode is brought to you by Storyworth. Now, Storyworth makes it easy and fun for your family to share their lives with weekly story prompts that culminate into a beautiful hardcover book. Storyworth is the perfect Mother's or Father's Day gift for the entire family. Go to storyworth.com/TCB to save $20 on a Storyworth subscription.
I like that concept. It's pretty cool.
It is. We'll talk about it a little bit.
Yes.
Yeah. But today we're talking about Fatal Father. So we're talking about a young couple, Francis and Darren Jenkinson of Glasgow, Scotland. And they were happy and attentive parents of 8-week-old baby boy Aaron in 1995, when tragedy struck. After 3 bouts of difficulty breathing, the baby boy had irreversible brain damage and he was taken off of life support. The loss of her baby was especially difficult for Frances, of course, and she was only 18 years old. But after taking some time to grieve and to heal, the couple had a second child in 1999, another boy who they named Jacob. Now, baby Jacob was only 3 weeks old when he met the same fate as Aaron, and his death brought about suspicion. Further investigation would reveal the unimaginable. So in this episode of True Crime Brewery, Fatal Father, we're going to examine the backgrounds of Francis and Darren Jenkinson. Were there signs that could have predicted the deaths of these two murdered infants? We will revisit Munchausen by proxy syndrome, rarely perpetrated by men, I might add, and discuss the events leading up to and following the deaths of little Aaron and Jacob, the murdered innocents. First things first, of course, though, I'm going to thank some of our 5-star reviewers.
Let's hear the 5 stars.
So thank you from the bottom of our hearts. V.M. Della Lama, Catherine Fontaine, Asthma the Driver, FLGirl1229, $1234, Ashley Bryce, Digal704, Bluer Eyed Devil, Nurse Tammy, Muppet's Mom, Dumb Game Reviewer, Don Von Pogen, DirtGirl88, and of course, Gonzo the OK.
Who can forget Gonzo the OK?
He will forever remain in our hearts.
He will.
Yes. And what do we have for a beer to sip as we ponder Gonzo and his OKness?
We have McEwen's Scotch Ale, which is brewed by the Caledonian Brewing Company in Edinburgh, Scotland. Bet you didn't think I could find a Scottish beer.
I knew you could. I always have faith in your beer prowess.
So, McEwen's is a Scotch ale, also known as a wee heavy. These are strong ales. That's part of the place that wee heavy comes from. They're strong.
I recall you doing a review on a wee heavy some time back.
We've done this before. These are beers that are boiled for a longer time to get more caramelization, which makes for a deep copper to brown ale in color. They tend to be sweeter, full-bodied, higher in alcohol, and they have a more pronounced caramel or toffee flavor. That's from the longer boil.
Okay.
So this particular one, McEwen's, and I haven't had this for several years. I mean, I used to drink a fair amount of these because I like the darker beers, as you know.
Yes, yep.
And this was a pretty good one. On revisiting it for this episode, I'm less enthralled by it.
Really?
Yeah.
So do you think that your tastes have evolved?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
And that may be good or may not be, but doesn't taste like I remembered it tasting.
Well, last week we went back to Molson, which you used to think was great.
I did.
And now you didn't feel so great about that. So I guess we could kind of go over your life and your personal growth in beers.
Well, we could do that, but we probably won't.
Okay, I'm sure the listeners will appreciate if we don't do that.
I'm sure they will. So this beer, McEwen's, is a dark brown color, pretty scant-looking head to the beer, has a sweet caramel malt aroma with some dark fruit. Got to have the fruit. So it's got a taste of caramel, predominantly, some prune or fig, and then there's a hint of peat. We've had some peaty beers before, kind of that smoky, peaty taste.
Not my favorite, I'd have to say.
And a little cinnamon.
Cinnamon's now, okay.
Despite this beer was a little bit on the thinner side. It wasn't as robust as I would have liked. And it certainly wasn't as robust as I recalled it from my younger drinking days.
Mm-hmm.
But still, pretty good beer. Give it a go.
Give it a go. Okay. All right.
Aye, lassie. Let us go down to the quiet inn.
All right, and we'll talk about this fatal father.
He's a very devious person.
Absolutely. Now, poor Frances, she was only 17 when she met 21-year-old Darren Jenkinson, and they spent every waking moment together for several weeks, deep in the throes of young love.
Would it be fair to say that Frances was a little naive
in
the romance department.
Yes. Don't try and do the whole podcast in a Scottish accent.
I wasn't trying to do that.
Oh, okay. All right.
Would you say that she was a little naive in the romance department?
Well, if she's 17, of course. Yes, I would.
So she's not particularly experienced.
No.
And she's swept off her feet by this handsome older man.
Absolutely. So they're deep in the throes of young love, as I worded it.
That works.
Yep. So they walked the beaches in Blackpool, hand in hand, and Darren quickly proposed, and Frances said yes. So later she would describe their courtship as a bit of a whirlwind. Frances was the center of Darren's life, as he didn't seem to have any other friends or family nearby.
Red flag.
Now, shortly after their engagement, the young couple moved to Glasgow. Now, initially, they lived with Frances's mother, Elizabeth Graham, and Elizabeth said that she liked Darren. She thought he was very cheerful and friendly, and they seemed happy. They kind of welcomed him into the family because he didn't have any around, and they were a close-knit family.
Right. But don't you think, I know I blurted out red flag there, but
yeah,
this is a guy that doesn't have many friends or anything. He's kind of a loner.
It's something to be cautious of, yes, I agree.
Absolutely.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But it's hard for a young girl getting that kind of attention not to be swept away with it.
Yeah, no, I can see that.
Yeah.
This is all hindsight, which is always a good way to view things.
Right, right. So they're living with her mother, and then in late 1994, Frances became pregnant with their first child. So that following spring, Frances and Darren went ahead and got married, and Frances thought it was really nice that he wanted to have their wedding on her 18th birthday. So they did that. But looking back, she wasn't sure why they moved so fast in getting married and having a family. I mean, she was terribly young.
She was. But I can see getting married. She's pregnant. That's an impetus to getting married.
Sure. So Frances's mom, dad, sisters, and close friends attended their small wedding ceremony that spring. But no one from Darren's side was there. So this, as you said, is clearly a red flag that Darren may not have had the best childhood, the best family relationships. But Frances didn't really think about it because she's young, she's busy, she's newly married, she's about to have a baby. There's a lot on her mind.
True.
Now, Frances's pregnancy was uneventful. She gave birth to a healthy, full-term baby boy in July of 1995, and they named him Aaron. But then a distance began to develop between Frances and Darren after they became parents. Pictures from Frances's hospital stay show Darren on the bed holding Aaron, and Frances is sitting off to the side. So it seems like Darren wanted to kind of be the center of attention with the baby's birth, with the baby coming into the world and people coming to visit and all that.
Right. I know this is hindsight, but I thought that was a very telling picture.
Yes.
There's Darren front and center with the newborn, and mom, who's been in labor and delivered this kid, is kind of off to the side.
Yeah, now this is something you see. You visit parents after they've had their baby.
I do.
How often do you see the father in the bed with the baby and the mom off to the side? Is that unusual?
That's so unusual as to be rare.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
The baby is 99.9% of the time being held by mom.
Well, because when people come in and give attention for the baby, it's usually the mom's moment. She gave birth.
Right.
She's breastfeeding or whatever.
Put all that work into it.
Yeah.
I mean, not to say that the father's not involved.
Right.
But he is not front and center, as you said, with the newborn.
Mom, not so much.
Mom
yeah.
is.
Right. But in what we saw, it seemed like Darren tried to kind of get a lot of attention out of it, which
yeah.
is something else we could just add to all these small little things that turn it into one big picture.
Right.
So, but if there were signs of trouble to come, they were subtle, as I said. So, of course, one concerning thing about Darren was his need to spend all of his time with Frances, as well as his lack of other people, such as family members or friends, in his life. Another possible warning sign was Darren's choice of a younger woman, a girl, really. I mean, a 4-year age difference is not a big deal, but she was a girl. She wasn't even 18.
Right.
And so he chose a girl, really, to start a relationship with instead of another adult woman.
Yeah. And I would wager that's because he thought that she would be more amenable to doing his bidding, his wishes.
And she was, I imagine.
Yeah.
So I think that was something he was comfortable with.
Sure.
If not a conscious choice, it would be something he would gravitate toward.
Well, again, we're talking about a relatively naive and experienced person.
Yeah.
In her. So, yeah, I can see where she'd kind of accede to her husband's wishes and do what the older, more wise person wanted to do.
Well, I mean, even Frances would confess that she was deeply in love with Darren, very taken and very infatuated with him from the start.
Okay.
So that would make her more open to doing whatever he wanted.
Well, I mean, I think that's two different issues.
Okay.
I think you can be passionately in love with somebody and not always doing what they wanted.
Well, yes, right? You could, but if you're naive and you're dependent,
okay.
It kind of goes together, I'd say.
I'll grant that.
Okay. So her youth, her inexperience, it made her easier to control and to get her undivided attention, of course. So when Darren met Frances in Blackpool, she had been on her own there, and she didn't really know many people there either. She was away from her family for, like, the first time.
Right.
So when the couple moved to Glasgow, Darren continued to seek the sole attention of Frances, and he wanted to control her life. And in fact, Darren was often out of work, and Frances would say that he seemed to prefer it that way so they could spend all of their time together, so they didn't have to separate even to go out and make a living.
Yet another flag, huh?
Yes.
I mean, here's this guy who's more interested in being home and monopolizing the attentions of his wife and newborn.
Yes.
Instead of working.
Well, even before they had a newborn, just her.
Right.
Yeah.
So I take it they were on welfare or on the dole?
On the dole, yep.
Okay.
Well, Frances had worked back in Blackpool, and she'd taken college courses when she was back there, but she stopped when they moved to Glasgow, and that was at Darren's request.
Uh-huh.
Now, Frances's sister, Pauline, noticed early on that Darren was very obsessed with Frances. Pauline seemed to be a little more street smart. She seemed to cue into things more quickly.
Pauline was the older sister?
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, according to Pauline, if she and her sister went out, Darren would just turn up where they were. Now, if Frances visited Pauline's house, Darren would either come with her or he'd show up a little while later. And he'd say something like, oh, I just wanted to check on you. But wherever Frances was, Darren would just appear, like he didn't want to be separated from her.
Yeah, now that's just creepy.
And this is the 90s, so I'm thinking she might not have had a cell phone with her all the time because they didn't have much money. It's the 90s.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yep. So Darren would act as if he was just saying hello or he's just checking in on Frances, but Pauline really saw Darren as an obsessed guy, a controlling guy. She seemed to be able to kind of suss out what he was really about when other members of the family didn't.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously the wife, Frances, who's infatuated with this guy, isn't going to observe too closely these kinds of character flaws.
Well, and as someone so young, she's flattered.
Right.
Well, he wants to be with me all the time. Isn't that flattering?
Now, her mom, though, I mean, she thought Darren was a great guy.
She did. She was right on board with it as well.
The only one who was more suspicious is his older sister.
Yes.
And even that, I mean, it doesn't sound like she voiced these suspicions. This is, again, just more afterthought type stuff.
Well, early on, she was careful. Right? She was careful. She didn't want to hurt her sister's feelings.
Sure.
And you don't know how bad it is in the beginning. Just, you know, well, gee, he's a little controlling. Doesn't necessarily mean anything horrible is going to happen. It's another subtle detail.
Right.
Right. So, did Darren want Frances all to himself? That's a question. I mean, even as they moved on to be parents, was this an issue for him? So, if he's that into competing for her attention, was he that way even with his own baby? And could that have led to some of the tragic events that followed? That's something you need to consider, right? What do you think of that?
I think there's a strong likelihood of that, right?
Okay. I think so, too. So after Aaron was born, Darren became a hypochondriac more than ever. He'd always had a few of these kind of, I don't know, issues, parts of his personality, but he became a pretty hardcore hypochondriac.
Yeah, well, more so. But
more so,
I mean,
yes.
I think he, from what we've read and looked at, he was a seeker of medical attention.
Yes.
Quite a bit.
He was.
For seemingly minor illnesses.
Or even non-existent illnesses,
perhaps. Or even non-existent. But he did become worse after the infant was born.
Yes. Well, it's believed that he became obsessed with getting attention from the medical world, and that maybe having a pregnant wife with the frequent obstetrical visits kind of satisfied this craving for him. Because when you're in a pregnancy, you do see the doctors quite often.
Right. As a couple.
As a couple, yep. So he got to participate in that.
Yeah.
And that may have become something he enjoyed. He was clearly lacking any kind of creative or professional outlet in his life.
Certainly.
Then he began to have these constant health complaints, Francis would say, and doctor visits, to the point where the local doctor just knew him by the first name. And he was going to the doctor 2-3 times a week.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, we have some of those parents in our practice.
Yes.
I mean, it's not to that extent, but yeah, they are frequent flyers, as we call them.
Yes, right. There are people like that. And I think it crosses a line when you get to the point of where you're actually creating illnesses, to the point of where you're worrying about them.
Right.
I think a lot of people worry about them, but then when you get to the point where you're actually making someone sick, that's a whole other level, probably a lot more rare.
That's true.
Okay.
Yes. I mean, most of the time, these are people that are just more concerned about their child's health.
Yes,
than
right.
other parents.
And
so,
I think you
so
see...
So they cough frequently.
I think you see that a lot maybe with older parents who are know too much in some ways, are searching the internet and every little thing that happens.
Yeah, I don't know that it's that specific, that it's typically older parents.
Okay.
It can be younger, for sure.
Okay. And these were definitely younger parents.
Yeah. We have a saying in the office, when you're on call, 90% of your calls come from 10% of your patients.
Sure, yeah.
So, or put it another way, I can almost always recognize the person who's calling me.
Yes.
It's very rare to get the name of a person who's calling and say, who are they?
Yeah.
Because there are people that call frequently.
There are. That's absolutely true.
And here's Darren, who not only called frequently, but visited the doctors frequently with a long litany of complaints.
Yes. And supposedly he's a young, healthy individual.
Yeah. He's 21, 22 now, right?
Yeah. So then Darren began to exhibit other strange attention-seeking behavior that Francis would notice. One day, for example, when Francis and the baby were at a friend's house, Francis got a call from Darren saying that there'd been a fire at their place. Darren had been out walking the dog, and when he came back, the house was on fire. So Darren was the only member of the home that smoked, and the fire department found that a lit cigarette in the couch had started the fire. So where did the cigarette come from, if not from Darren? Was a question that came to Francis's mind right away.
Well, the answer's simple. It came from Darren.
Right. Well, he'd been the one to see smoke coming from the window, and he'd been the one to call the fire department. But police couldn't prove that Darren had started the fire, but Francis recalled other fires in their past where Darren had always been the hero, and he'd always been the one to call 999, which is the 911 in Scotland, of course.
Well, so, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So now she's looking back with this latest fire and recognizing, oh, yeah, there's been other instances of fires.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really strange.
It is. And fire setting is a huge warning sign.
Isn't it?
Yeah, for many things.
Yes.
Right? And it shows that his attention-seeking behavior went to dangerous lengths. That's the concerning part. You know, he's okay with putting other people's lives at risk so he can play the hero.
Yeah.
So that's scary.
It certainly is.
Especially in a young father. So in September of 1995, after several weeks of good health, baby Aaron Jenkinson began to have episodes of breathing difficulty. The problem first appeared one night when Darren got up in the night to feed Aaron. And it was a weekend night. Francis was asleep when Darren ran into the bedroom and he's saying, "He's not breathing, he's gone blue." So this is the first time that the baby is involved in these issues.
Right, and he's only a few weeks old.
Yes.
So Aaron was rushed to the hospital by ambulance, stayed there for 5 days. During his stay, Francis roomed in with him. Darren stayed with him during the day and went home at night. Now, during this time, there were no further apnea or breathing episodes.
No. Nope.
In the hospital.
No, there weren't.
That's a big point, as we'll see.
Yes.
Frances remembers him, Darren, as remaining calm, which she was thankful for at the time. So baby Aaron was discharged home after 5 days, stable.
Yeah.
By the next Friday, which is just a few days later, it happened again.
Okay, well, can we just rewind for a second and tell me what kind of tests they would have run? She said there were some horrible tests, so the baby was put through some suffering with this.
He was.
These weren't just observations. He was probably poked and prodded a bit.
Well, there's a long list of things that could cause apnea, which is absence of breathing.
Yes.
In case people don't know that. I think everybody must know what apnea
probably,
is.
Probably, but it's okay to say that.
So he stopped breathing. So the things you're going to be looking for would be infectious processes, cardiac problems, pulmonary lung problems.
Especially at this super young age.
Right.
Yes.
So the most pressing thing would be, could he have an infection?
But wouldn't it be odd that he was maintaining his temperature?
No, not in newborns.
Okay.
Newborns don't always run fevers. He wasn't running a fever.
No.
So, but he probably had a bunch of blood work done. He probably had a spinal tap done.
And that is very painful, right? That's when they put a needle right in the spine.
Right.
And it can involve more than one puncture to get the right spot.
It can. So it's not the most pleasant procedure.
No.
He probably had testing done on his heart in terms of a electrocardiogram, maybe an echocardiogram. Probably had x-rays done of his chest. He might have, this was in the 90s, he might have had an apnea monitor, which was used extensively back in those days, but doesn't really do anything. So,
well, it's stressful.
Stressful for the parents, for
right,
sure.
Right, because it can go off just from misplacement of the monitor or movement of the baby,
yeah,
things like
there's,
that.
There's all sorts of false alarms.
Okay.
So they probably did a fairly extensive workup. He was there for several days.
But I bet that Darren got a lot of medical attention in that.
Well,
in that
sure.
stay, there was a lot of attention on this.
There had to have been. And after all, he was the one who had found him in that condition. So
he'd be the historian that they'd be talking to.
He's the historian. He's the concerned father.
Right.
So lots of secondary gain.
Yes. Okay. I just wanted to detail it a little bit for everyone.
Okay. So, like I said, he went home, and a few days later, he had another apneic episode. And over the next 3 weeks, he suffered three nearly identical episodes. Interestingly, all three of these were discovered by Darren, who called 999 each time. The baby was put through numerous tests, because he was obviously hospitalized each time he had one of these spells.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was a big deal each time he had a spell. The ambulance was called. It was trauma.
Right. Although the stress and worry were overwhelming for Frances.
Of course.
Darren seemed excited by all the attention. He enjoyed sitting up front in the ambulance and talking with the paramedics. He even bragged to friends about how he had ridden in the front seat of the ambulance. He also enjoyed using medical terminology. And I think that's one of the things we'll talk about in terms of Munchausen syndrome, that these people that suffer from the malady are fairly learned in medical literature.
Yeah, I might go so far as to suggest that people listening might want to go back and listen to our Lacey Spears Munchausen by Proxy episode, because we really went in depth to it, and she was kind of, I don't know, the poster child. She was like, she
yeah.
met all the criteria.
She certainly did.
She was a case that really...
I can go over... I mean, we haven't talked about Munchausen yet, so I'll
we'll
do that
go over
later,
it a little bit,
but I can go over it some more.
But I definitely think if you have an interest in that kind of thing, that's an episode to go back to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, Darren, as you said, he's showing some signs of Munchausen, and perhaps Munchausen by proxy, right? Because
right.
he had his own multiple health complaints. There was also the fire starting and the calls to the fire department. And he seemed very involved in the hospital when Aaron was born. And now, of course, he's involved in the emergency breathing issues with their son, Aaron. So do you want to say a little bit about Munchausen and Munchausen by proxy, just kind of what
sure.
they are? Most people know, but...
I think most people know, but I always find this an interesting story.
It's a fascinating topic.
It is. So let's have a little background. Baron Munchausen is a fictional nobleman created by a German writer, Rudolf Erich Raspe, in a book written in the late 1700s. So the character, Baron von Munchausen, is loosely based on a real baron, Hieronymus Karl Friedrich Freiherr von Munchausen. This real-life Munchausen fought for the Russian Empire in the Russian-Turkish War of 1735. On his return, he became a minor celebrity in German aristocratic circles for telling outrageous tall tales based on his military career.
Okay.
So the fictional Baron had all these fantastic exploits that were totally unbelievable. So that's the background.
That's where it came from. Okay.
Now, the syndromes, Munchausen syndrome was first described in 1951, and it's a psychiatric factitious disorder wherein those affected feign disease, illness, or psychological trauma to draw attention, sympathy, or reassurance for themselves. The affected person exaggerates or creates symptoms of illness in themselves. So that's Munchausen. And then 25 or more years later, Munchausen by proxy came about. This is Munchausen syndrome, behavior though characterized by an adult towards a child, which ensures that the child will experience some medical affliction, and this will compel the child to suffer through treatments and hospital stays.
Okay.
So Munchausen is fictitious illness in yourself. Munchausen by proxy is factitious illness in a child or another person.
So by definition, if you're calling and saying you think your child has meningitis because they have a headache, that's not Munchausen. You have to actually make them ill.
Right.
Something has to be done to them.
Yes. You have to. You can't simply calling up and saying, I'm worried that my child has meningitis is nothing near Munchausen.
Right, right.
But doing something to the child so that the child could mimic symptoms of meningitis is possibly Munchausen.
And I think that's an important distinction.
It is.
Okay, so Darren is showing some signs of Munchausen and Munchausen by proxy. So also, what about this fire starting and calling the fire department? That's a different psychological issue, isn't it?
Well, that is. But I mean, it still comes down to the fact that he's getting to be the hero. He's called in the fire.
Right, right. Okay. So the fourth time that Darren called 999 because his son wasn't breathing and was turning blue would be the last time. It was a Friday night. After getting up to change Aaron's diaper, Darren woke Frances, saying that the baby was blue and wasn't breathing. So poor Frances, she stood by crying and frantic as Darren calmly administered CPR to Aaron on the living room floor. Paramedics arrived and attempted to resuscitate baby Aaron, and then he was taken to the hospital. But he would never breathe on his own again. Frances had to come to terms with taking Aaron off of the life support during that hospitalization. So Aaron, he died on the 14th of October, 1995, at only 8 weeks of age. But the pathologist's report recorded the cause of death as a rare congenital heart disorder. So they're saying that his death was possibly from a congenital heart disorder. Do you think that's possible? I mean, how would they have come up with that?
I don't know how they would come up with that. There's just nothing to suggest that he had a congenital heart disease.
I would imagine they'd be able to tell.
And, yeah, I think that they just screwed up the postmortem exam.
I wonder why they didn't just say SIDS.
I don't know.
Okay.
But the things that are going to cause sudden death would have been discovered in his workup.
Right.
Prior
right.
to him dying.
Unless it was sudden infant death, because there really isn't any way to...
Well, yeah, but that's not a cardiac problem.
True.
Well, so to suggest that he had some rare unexplained heart disease just doesn't ring true.
Right, right. Well, Darren, he played the part of a grieving father, and in a memory book, Frances and Darren each wrote a letter to baby Aaron. Looking back and reading Darren's letter, Frances would say that she was a little bit troubled because in Frances's letter, she talks about who Aaron was, his smile, how he enjoyed his bath, you know, whatever little things a baby that young could do. But Darren's letter was mostly I statements talking about how Aaron's death had affected him. And I know that's a subtle difference, but looking back, it is telling, I think.
No question. I mean, it's still all about Darren.
Yes, right.
And the mother, Frances, wrote this very heartfelt letter.
She did.
About her infant son.
Of course, yeah.
And comparing it to Darren's note, It was just night and day.
Yeah, it was. Well, a few weeks after Aaron's death, Francis and Darren moved out of Glasgow, and they tried to make a new start. So they moved to Nottingham into a high-rise apartment, and Francis took a job working in care, like in elder care, and she really threw herself into her work.
Meanwhile, Darren stayed home.
I don't know. I think he might have.
Yeah, he did.
He did off and on do some things, like he worked in fast food. And
for a short time, he worked like minimal wage type jobs for short times.
Right. Never really stuck it out.
No.
But caring for the elderly was really something that Frances would love. It took her mind off of her loss, for one thing. And while she was at work, she was distracted from her pain, and she was able to help people that she was caring for. But she was still grieving, of course, and she did have some nagging doubts, actually, about what happened to her baby. So one night, crying, Frances brought up her doubts with Darren. And she asked him, you know, why did these episodes only happen at night, I wonder? And why only on the weekends?
And why only when you were attending the baby?
Yeah, so she had some genuine concerns. I
mean, there's some major concerns there.
And maybe not necessarily accusing him, but just wondering why this pattern.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I guess. I think she's getting to the point of thinking that he was involved.
Maybe. Maybe even other people had mentioned that. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like I'm thinking maybe Sister Pauline had asked.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Darren reminded Francis, though, of the post-mortem report, so he took the report and he put it in front of her for her to see, which I thought was kind of cold thing to do with your spouse. You've lost a child together. You're going to show them the post-mortem report? And wouldn't you just hold each other and talk about the child? Why would you do that?
You wouldn't.
Almost like defending himself.
It's going to validate his defense.
Right. So when she continued to question the episodes, Darren also became defensive. He said, "Do you think I did something? I was his father. How could you think I'd done something?" And of course, he was persuasive with her, and he was also pretty manipulative and experienced at lying to her. So eventually, Darren was able to convince Frances to put her doubts to rest and to look forward to the future. So after 2 years in Nottingham, the couple returned to Glasgow and decided to try for another baby. They had difficulty at first, and Frances had to begin fertility treatments. Now, to me, it seems strange that Darren would support Frances's getting fertility treatments to have another child. But he does have these aspects of Munchausen by proxy, so getting fertility treatments, maybe that fulfilled his need for attention from the medical community?
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that was what he was looking for.
But if he killed the first baby, why would he want her to have another? That's what I wonder. Unless just for the attention,
well,
which is really creepy.
It is for the attention.
That's awful.
He gets to be the head man again.
He has, like, no consideration for this baby as an individual life at all.
None whatsoever.
It's all about how it can serve his needs.
Yes.
Pretty sick. Well, in 1998, Francis and Darren got a house on Granton Street in Glasgow, and while living in the house, Francis found out she was pregnant. So on August 29th, 1999, the couple's second son, Jacob, was born. And as with Aaron, Darren was a doting father with him. He cut the cord at the birth, he changed diapers, got up for feedings, and he was very involved. And Francis thought that he really seemed to adore their new son.
So I'm just wondering if with the second baby, if Francis was more cautious about allowing Darren to be caring for the baby unattended.
Doesn't seem to be, but it could be. I mean, we weren't in their house.
I know.
Maybe she was.
I mean, it sounds like she was suspicious of him.
Sure does.
And in that case, I'd be watching that guy like a hawk.
Well, I don't think she was that suspicious to the point of consciously trying to defend the baby.
Apparently not.
She may have had some doubts in the back of her mind.
Plus, she had the autopsy report.
And that's the thing. I mean, she's a, 18, 19-year-old, and the professionals have written this report. You know, why would you not believe it?
Right.
Right? Why would they say the baby had that condition if the baby didn't?
Exactly.
So I think that would really is what kept her from being too suspicious. Don't you think?
I think so.
Well, I'd like to take a moment now just to tell our listeners about today's sponsor, Storyworth, that we mentioned earlier. Now, every family has a patriarch or a matriarch who really tells the best stories, right?
Right.
And in my family, it's my dad. But, you know, dad takes some prodding. Then once you get started, we learn things we didn't know about our parents, our aunts, our uncles, even our grandparents. So this year, I bought a subscription to Storyworth. So each week, Storyworth's team emails questions to my dad for him to answer and share with our family. And then at the end of the year, Storyworth will send a hardcover book to our son with my dad's stories. So this is going to be a wonderful keepsake that my son can treasure and we can pass on down through future generations.
It's a great idea.
We can actually have copies given to anyone we want, daughters, cousins.
Yeah.
Kind of tell dad's story throughout the family. So I definitely recommend Storyworth. It's really an excellent way to preserve some family memories, and it's ideal for a last-minute Mother's or Father's Day gift. So no need to drive to the store. Just go to storyworth.com/TCB and tell them Dick and Jill sent you. Not really, because it would be really silly to say that to a website.
It probably would.
But you want to use that code, TCB, when you go there to get your $20 off.
You get a $20 discount.
That's right.
And what a great thing. I mean, I remember growing up, my grandparents had wonderful stories to tell. This would be just a fantastic thing to do.
I think it is. And the books look really nice. We haven't gotten ours yet, but they look like they're very well done. I'll put some pictures out on our social media of some of the books' examples, because they're really nice.
That's a good idea.
It's a perfect gift. So, after Jacob was home for only a few days, he started having difficulty breathing, like Aaron had, and Frances was shocked and terrified, of course. This is her worst fear come to life, that it happens with her next boy, who's been healthy. So, at 3 weeks old, Jacob stopped breathing and turned blue when Darren had gotten up with him in the night to feed him. So, Jacob was resuscitated and hospitalized, but then he had 3 days of testing, and it was inconclusive, and he was returned home with his parents. Very similar to what happened with Aaron.
Sounds suspicious.
So I can't imagine what Frances is going through at this point.
Yeah, and I'm thinking at this point, the exact same thing happened with the second son as the first son. She's got to be thinking that her husband's involved somehow.
Could be thinking it, but it's such a huge step to think that. It's just not a normal thing to think.
I know it's not.
Especially since he seems like a very doting father. Now, the third time that Jacob was rushed to the hospital, he died. Frances's family gathered in the hospital to say goodbye to Jacob as he was taken off of the respirator, and he died in Frances's arms at just 3 weeks old. So this was a lot earlier than with Aaron, who was 8 weeks old.
Right.
Now, Darren seemed less concerned with playing the grieving father this time, though. He seemed quite relaxed, actually, eating large meals in the hospital cafeteria, and actually making some very insensitive remarks. Poor Frances was inconsolable, but her sisters and her mother remained at her side. So what do you think about the three-week factor? You want to get into that now, or do you want to wait till after we're done with the story?
Well, I would just talk about fathers as perpetrators of Munchausen by proxy, but I think I'll wait a little bit.
Oh, you want to wait, because I would like to hear that. Okay, let's finish the story, and then we'll get into that.
Yeah.
So because of Darren's odd behavior and the concerns of the nursing staff at the hospital, suspicions were raised, and medical records included Aaron's death, of course, that had happened 4 years previously. This concerned the police, but the postmortem report indicated that Aaron had died of a congenital heart defect, so that was a problem for the police.
A big problem.
But there were striking similarities also in how the two infants had presented. Even the times of night, the days that were on the weekend, and Darren always being the one to be with the babies matched up. Both babies had suffered unexplained breathing difficulties, and each baby had spontaneously stopped breathing for no known medical reason. Now, Aaron's death had been determined to be of natural causes, but even though Jacob's death was considered suspicious, no one in the medical community would go ahead and say that it was a murder. So Darren was considered a suspect in Jacob's death, but the police only had circumstantial evidence and the suspicions of the medical nursing staff, because at this point, Frances and the family were not coming forward with suspicions.
No,
they were behind Darren.
They were standing with Darren.
Now, Darren was the only person with the babies when they stopped breathing, and Jacob's pathology report read that murder was probable, but not conclusive. So in an effort to find out more, of course, Darren was interviewed by the police, and he seemed cooperative. He even seemed eager to help. He came to the police station alone and agreed to the interview. And after about 6 hours of interrogation, The detective asked Darren if there was something he wasn't sharing with the police. And this is when Darren nodded his head. And then he did make a confession.
Wow, just like that.
Well, 6 hours. It's not like that.
But he's maintained his innocence for 6 hours.
Yes.
And then they ask this one question and boom.
Right.
He caves.
Sure, but I'm sure there was a lot of questioning leading up to that that put him in that position.
Well, they were pretty certain that he was involved.
Yes, I think so. Police were really, though, unsettled by how calm and matter-of-fact the confession was. Darren didn't seem devastated. He wasn't crying. He didn't even really seem upset. So that kind of haunted one of the detectives to just sit there and watch this man describe killing his own children in such a matter-of-fact, kind of blasé manner.
Yes.
That could be very disturbing. I mean, this guy, this detective, he'd seen a lot of crimes, but this just kind of threw him off. Because most people, even when they commit horrific crimes, do feel something about it.
Yeah. I mean, when they confess, they're pretty emotional.
I would guess so.
Not old Darren.
Not Darren. He explained the actions he took leading to his son's deaths in detail. And he said that he'd suffocated them by putting their bibs over their faces to cover their mouths and noses. And Frances, she came out of her police interview that was happening the same day, and she learned that Darren had confessed. So she went home with her sister Pauline, and she was determined that she wouldn't be speaking with him again. But the next day, Darren retracted his confession. He claimed that he'd been tricked into making a false confession. Now, Frances's mother just couldn't believe that he had done it. She believed Darren was innocent. So from his jail cell, Darren's kind of started this campaign to win Frances back, and he wrote letters to her to convince her that he was actually innocent. He wrote very little about how Frances was feeling, though. He mostly wrote about how he needed her, how he was on suicide watch, and how hard it was for him to be in jail.
Yes.
So it's still all about Darren.
It's all about Darren still.
But I think that Frances is kind of used to focusing on Darren. She's been with him all this time.
Well,
this is the pattern in the relationship.
Several years into this relationship, yeah. She knows him.
Right. So manipulating Frances and appealing to her sympathy, Darren did finally convince her to come and visit him in the jail after his confession.
So she does. She goes to visit him. And she felt sorry for Darren. After 7 months of contact, Darren had convinced her that he was innocent. He was offered bail if he had a place to stay. Under the belief that he had been coerced into the confession, Frances allowed Darren to stay with her until his trial.
Surprises me, but then I think, if her mother's believing him,
yeah,
she's got support for it.
She's got everybody, maybe except for her sister, but everybody in her family's supportive of Darren.
Because why would you think that someone that you care about in your family would do something like that? I can understand that.
Right. During this time together, according to Frances, they didn't discuss the case at all. His lies had worked on Frances and her mother. But Frances's sister knew that he was guilty. And this tore Frances's family apart.
It sure did.
Frances's sister Pauline was convinced that Darren had killed the babies. But Frances wouldn't consider it any longer. She was supporting Darren. Pauline didn't attend her nephew Jacob's funeral because the family was torn. She went to the gravesite after everyone had left to say goodbye to Jacob. So it's like Pauline's against everyone else.
Yeah, so this is a way that Darren was really adding insult to injury.
Yeah.
And he's just making
split
it worse.
The family.
Here's Frances, who's lost 2 children and is suffering. And he doesn't care. He's going to make it worse by making her relationship with her sister strained.
Right.
And separating her from other support that she could have. So he's super horrible. that's the best I can come up with.
That's
but
a
he
good
is
term.
Just he's just terrible.
How about just a despicable human?
Thank you. That's a good description. He'd convince Frances and her mother, but convincing a jury, maybe that wouldn't be so easy, right? So,
well, he's got a confession. Even though he's retracted it, he's confessed.
It's out there.
Yeah.
So he went on trial in 2001 for the murder of his 2 baby boys, and Frances clung to the postmortem report of Aaron's death from a rare cardiac defect as the cause of both of her son's deaths. So that's what she's clinging to, is that there was just something genetic. And another sad thing about that is that she was blaming herself, like she was passing down genes to these kids.
Mm-hmm.
So she's actually blaming herself for this.
But there's nothing on Jacob's autopsy that suggested the same cardiac defect.
No.
That was described on the first child.
No, but as devil's advocate, I'd say you have these two reports. What makes one better than the other?
Well, I know.
Right? You don't know.
But it'd be nice if they were both the same.
Sure would. But she really didn't want to believe that Darren could have killed his own children, and I could understand that.
Yeah.
Now, 3 weeks into the trial, Darren's confession tapes were played to the court, and this was the real game changer. Because Frances, she didn't want to hear the tapes, and she left the courtroom, so she didn't even listen. But the tapes were so disturbing, because Darren calmly describes molding the baby's bibs around their mouths and noses to obstruct their breathing. Also, he admitted to holding the baby's legs still, as their legs started to twitch.
Yeah, they'd be thrashing around a little bit.
Yeah, horrific.
Yeah.
And Frances's mother, when she heard it, she changed her mind. She believed he was guilty.
Yeah.
So that was all it took for her.
And as the police said, it wasn't just the fact that he confessed. It was the way he confessed. He was so cold-blooded and matter-of-fact about things.
Right, and quite detailed.
Yeah, you had to think. This is a true story.
Yeah, this is a bad guy.
It is.
Yeah. So Frances's mother had changed her mind, and the jurors appealed, and the jurors appeared shocked, and some were even in tears as they listened. But Frances, she hadn't listened to the tapes, so she was just kind of staying out of it. So at this point, I think she's just kind of in denial mode. I don't want to deal with it. I'm not going to listen.
Yes.
And I can totally understand that. But Frances, the next day, got a call telling her that Darren wanted to see her. So she went to see Darren in his jail cell, and as soon as she got down there, he burst out crying and told her, "I did it."
Really?
Yep. So after seeing the impact of his confession, he changed his plea to guilty, because there was just no denying it once you'd heard those tapes, I guess.
He knew he was cooked.
Yes. But then he did claim diminished responsibility. So Darren claimed that he was driven to kill the babies by fears he would abuse them, as his father had done to him. He said that he had a vision of his father telling him he would turn out just like him. But the prosecution said his story was the classic response of a devious and deceitful mind.
Yeah, I'd look at it that way.
Yeah.
That's just too pat an excuse.
Well, I don't think it's an excuse. I think it could be true, but it's not an excuse.
Well, it's his excuse.
Yes, but I mean, I think it could be true that he had these thoughts, but there's a choice you make when you get these thoughts.
Well, absolutely.
And deciding, oh, I'll just kill them, is not the right choice.
We know that.
Now, defense psychiatrist Dr. Hamilton Campbell told jurors that, in her opinion, Jenkinson was suffering from diminished responsibility at the time of the killings. But psychiatrist George McDonald testified that he could find nothing to suggest that he suffered from a mental illness.
And you might add that the former was the psychiatrist for the defense and the latter was the psychiatrist for the prosecution.
Right, right.
So, plainly different viewpoints.
Yeah. Well, the jury didn't accept that his abusive childhood and his claims of diminished responsibility were mitigating factors at all.
Right.
So, it was on September 26th, 2001, when he was sentenced to life in prison for 2 counts of murder and 5 counts of attempted murder. So, why did Darren do this? That's the basic question. Because, if nothing else, we'd like to think that there, in some way, we can prevent future things like this happening as a society by discussing these things. I would hope that something would go towards prevention.
That'd be nice to think, wouldn't it?
Yes.
The difficulty is that I think too many of these red flags or concerns are things that you look at in retrospect. And at the time that they're occurring, they don't seem real important. But then once you know all the facts and you look back on things, you say, well, yeah, sure, here's something that would make you suspicious.
Right. So the warning signs are the fire starting, the controlling behavior.
Controlling behavior, the seeking of medical attention for himself.
Right.
Him being the one that always found the child or the children unresponsive.
Well, I would almost say at that point it's too late for prevention. Now the crime has begun.
You're right.
Yeah.
But again, these are things that at the time they occur, you might not think as much about.
Well, there were definitely issues in Darren's childhood that were hidden from Francis until they were brought forward in court. He was brought up by his family in Melton Mowbray, but then at age 6 he was taken into foster care, and he lived in over 30 different homes. Now, he claimed that he was sexually abused by his father, and he did become a disruptive, violent child. So, I think these are reasons, but I don't think they're excuses.
They're certainly probably contributing factors.
Right, that's a good way to put it. Because most people with abused childhoods decide not to be violent or abusive themselves. So, according to the Department of Health Statistics in Scotland, only 1 in 6 abused children grow up to be abusers. Now, of course, it's a much lower number that ends up killing their children. Much lower.
Way lower.
Yeah. So, it's not an excuse. It is a factor that affected who he was, I would imagine.
Yeah. But he's still the one who killed his kids.
He's still absolutely responsible, I believe. So, some of the early warning signs I would think would be that he was manipulative, selfish, almost narcissistic, would you say?
Yes.
Attention-seeking, controlling in the relationship. But can we pick up these signs to prevent crimes like these from happening again? You don't think we can, really. It's hard, at least.
I think it's really difficult. I mean, when we watched that program with the psychiatrist or whatever she was, I think she was a psychiatrist.
Yeah, there was a program on this called, a show called Killer in the Family, and this was episode 4, Baby Killer, right. That we watched.
The doctor was trying to look at signs that could be used to identify potential murderers or child abusers.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was just thinking that, yes, these signs are there, but at the time they occur, they might not be as worrisome as when you have all the facts at the end and you look back retrospectively and you say, well, yeah, this and this and this and this occurred.
Right. And a lot of people have a lot of these issues, but don't kill.
Yeah. So somebody who's narcissistic and self-centered doesn't necessarily mean they're going to go on to be murderers.
No, but I would probably tell most people just to steer clear of the narcissist in a relationship.
Well, that's a different story.
Yeah. But that's probably a good point.
That's not a healthy relationship.
Right. So why do it? Because you're just asking for trouble.
Right.
Yeah. Well, in 2006, Darren's sentence was cut from 30 years to 23 years by the Court of Criminal Appeal in Edinburgh, and a reduction of 6 years plus another year for good progress made in custody were given to him. And this decision was made with the explanation that Jenkinson's crimes were extremely grave, but that the 30 years were excessive. I guess the 30 years is saved for the most depraved of all crimes. And I don't know why, but this one didn't meet the criteria.
When you said that, I'm just thinking, so you killed an 8-week-old and a 3-week-old. It doesn't seem to get more depraved than that.
It doesn't. Can't get any more innocent than that, can you?
No.
So you can tell me now about your Munchausen by proxy in men. You said you read an article on that?
Yeah, because we have a guy who's been diagnosed tentatively with Munchausen by proxy, right? Darren?
Yes.
So I found an article that was written by a doctor who was one of the original describers of Munchausen by proxy in Great Britain. His name is Dr. Roy Meadows.
Okay.
Meadow. Not plural. And he wrote an article in the Archives of Diseases of Children in 1998 where he talked about Munchausen syndrome by proxy perpetrated by men. So he prefaces this by saying, for 10 or more years of dealing with this type of disorder, they were 100% female perpetrators.
100%?
100%.
Wow.
But then in the next 10 years, there were 15 instances of males being the perpetrators.
15 out of how many? Do we know?
No. You just
still a small percentage, I would imagine.
It's still overwhelmingly female.
Okay.
But there are male perpetrators. And he was discussing how males came to be identified.
Okay.
And his first thing was that there's more cases being identified now. So you're going to see more representation of both males and females just because people are more aware of it.
That's the way it works with most things, right?
Right.
Yeah.
The other thing is it's still predominantly female because who's the primary caretaker of the infants and children?
usually the female, because she gives birth.
The mother.
Yeah.
Right. But in his case studies, there were several cases where the male, the father, was the primary caretaker. So it doesn't have to be just the female.
But if a father has Munchausen by proxy, is he usually the primary caretaker then?
No.
He's not, okay.
In these cases he described, there were 15 cases. Four of the 15, the father was primary caretaker. So 11 of the 15, the mother was primary caretaker.
Wow, that surprises me a little bit.
But still, the father was the perpetrator.
Seemed like it would be harder to get away with if you're gone at work every day.
And I would just say one other thing, that even though Darren was described as Munchausen by proxy, the duration of symptoms wasn't that long. So he's a little atypical.
That's a big issue for me when talking about it. I felt like, why did he kill them so young?
Well, my theory is that he's trying to kill them and not just make them ill for the attention.
See, my theory is that he just fucked up. That he was just trying to cause these incidents, but fucked up and killed them.
Yeah.
Because he got carried away or whatever.
But he did it several times. I mean, if that's what happened, I mean, the first time you smother him, you screw up and you kill him.
Yeah, but he could have done it a few times and not screwed up, and then after a few times he screwed up. Like, you're trying it, and you say, oh, that worked, I'll just suffocate him a little, and then the fourth time you do it, he dies on you. Because he had no medical knowledge, and he liked the attention, so I kind of feel like he just screwed up, because he did it even sooner with the second one. So
he
with
did.
The first one...
So that's why I'm thinking he was trying to kill the kids.
Well, he said he tried to kill them because he thought he'd be an abusive father. I don't buy that.
No, that's bullshit.
Because he could have just left.
Yeah. But, you know, the typical course for a child with Munchausen by proxy is months and years.
Exactly.
I mean, they're in and out of hospitals and doctor's offices and undergoing testing and so on and so forth. And the primary caretaker or the primary person taking... I shouldn't just say the primary caretaker, because it might be husband or wife.
Right.
Or mother or father. But whoever is doing the deeds wants to continue getting the attention.
Sure.
So this is a long-term situation.
Well, I think he wanted it to be a long-term situation, but he messed up.
I think in this case he was trying to kill these kids.
I don't think so, because he was on the dole as well, and he would have kept getting dole money if he had a sick child, or if he had a child. I think he just wasn't very good at it, for lack of a better way to say it, and that he ended up killing them.
Okay. We'll agree to disagree.
Maybe he was careless. Maybe he didn't really care either way. But I don't think he necessarily wanted them dead. The only reason I could think he might have done that is if he felt like he was losing some of his wife's attention, and he wanted to get him out of the way. We did bring that up early on.
Yeah.
That he wanted all of her attention, so that could have been a factor.
Well... I would just submit that 3 weeks and 8 weeks is a very short life.
Well, of course.
And if you're looking for continued attention, you're not going to kill him.
Right.
And
but I'm not convinced.
He did it enough times. He knew kind of. No, you're shaking your head.
No.
You're not buying my argument that he knew.
I don't think he knew anything. I don't think he was very smart. I think he was
But yeah, look what he did. He for the first child, three times or so.
Yeah.
Before the fourth fatal time.
Yes.
So he knew what he was doing. He knew.
Well, he might have known, well, these three times that he came back home, I'll do it again. And then, but that time he didn't come back home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he did it for a longer time.
Maybe not. Who knows?
Okay. We're not going to agree on this one.
Well, we don't know.
We don't.
I think it could be either, but I do think you're right that it's not just Munchausen. There's more going on there. Munchausen by proxy. It's not just Munchausen by proxy. There is more to it.
There is.
Yeah. But I think that his decision to, if it was his decision to kill the children, that's not diminished responsibility. That's just narcissism.
Right.
So what is diminished responsibility in Scottish law? I wondered, so I looked it up.
Yeah, what is it?
Well, diminished responsibility...
But it didn't work for him.
No, it was turned down, but it's still an interesting topic.
Okay.
So in Scottish law, it's similar to diminished capacity in the U.S. law, which we know what that is pretty much.
So you don't know that what you're doing is wrong.
Well, kind of. Here's how it's described. It's a defense by excuse, by which defendants argue that although they broke the law, they should not be held fully criminally liable because their mental functions were diminished or impaired. So it's like a little, it's like a little bit mentally ill.
Like temporary insanity type of thing?
Kind of.
Okay.
So you can look more into it, but it seems like it's just that there was something interfering that he couldn't make the right decision. So I think that they were right to say no to him on that.
I'll bet that doesn't work very often anyway.
Probably not. Most insanity defenses are very rare anyway that they work.
Right.
Well, before we get to feedback, I'd just like to remind everyone of the ways to support True Crime Brewery. We try to make it easy. You can get TCB merchandise on our website, tiegrabber.com. You can also join Team Tiegrabber on our website for as little as $2 a month. Now, there are three options there depending on what you can afford. You can do $2 a month, $3 a month, or $5 a month. And once you're a member, you'll have full access to our members-only True Crime Brewery episodes. And we'll also send you a gift, a sticker, a bottle opener, or a snifter, depending on your monthly contribution. Now, we also have an Amazon affiliate link in our website. So if you just go to our website and click on Shop Amazon and support Tiegrabber, then whatever you buy on Amazon will be purchased at the same low price, and a small amount of Amazon's profits will be sent to us to help support us paying for the podcast. Now, other ways to give support. You can give us emotional and word-of-mouth support by giving us a 5-star review on iTunes. Also, it turns out that subscribing is important. I just learned this, that our rating in iTunes can be improved if you're subscribing. So if you're like me and you're just listening to a podcast and then you're done and then you check and listen, it would just help a lot if you could just click subscribe when you go to True Crime Brewery, because that'll help lift us up a little bit in the ratings. Also, please follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Tiegrabber Pods. And all that stuff will just help us make things a little bit easier in our world.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So anything else to say before we get to feedback, Dickie?
No, let's do some feedback.
Thank you again for your hard work there in researching.
Well, it's medical stuff. It's always fun.
All right. Let's have a little musical intermission.
Okay.
And then we'll go to feedback.
All right. Let's do it.
So leave your taxi waiting and turn and close my door and sit back down where you were sitting a little closer than before. And when you look that serious, it just makes me want you more. And I've been meaning to tell you, the closer you get, the better I feel. The closer you are, the more I see why everyone says that I look happier when you're around. The closer you get, better I feel. And yes, I know you're nervous, never seen you so unsure. You haven't touched your food tonight and you're drinking more and more. And there's no need to hurry, take your time, I'll still be here. And I've been meaning to tell you, the closer you get, the better I feel, the closer you are.
Welcome to feedback. So I have a comment from YouTube from CCCEO on Shaken Baby Syndrome, the murder of Matthew Eapen. So, Cece says, mistake immediately. Au pairs are not meant to be nannies. Au pairs should only, under British law, do housework and supervise children for 5 hours a day. The main point of being an au pair is to give young people the opportunity to stay with a family, almost like an elder daughter, and explore the country and culture. I like your shows, but I really don't feel you've researched the definition of being an au pair. Nannies are trained, more mature, and cost a lot more money. Of course, Louise didn't go to the States to be a substitute mother. So I kind of feel like the Eapens felt that she was a nanny, though. They had her working during the day, so maybe it wasn't really the communication wasn't good between the Eepins and the
I would agree.
Au pair agency.
I mean, the expectation on the Eepins' part seems to be that she would be caring for the children.
Yeah, and I have gotten some feedback in the past about this, that an au pair should only be doing some supervision a few hours a day, but I don't know if that's the way it works in reality.
Right.
I really haven't researched that, but it just seems that in that case...
There wasn't any reason to research that.
No, in that case...
You could call her an au pair, but she functioned in a different category.
She certainly did. They expected her to do... And I don't know if that was the agency's idea or if the Eepins came up with that on their own.
Right.
I would want to question the agency and see if communication was... If they were saying the same thing to the Eepins that they were saying to Louise, because it seems like communication was an issue there.
Exactly. And I would just say I have some au pairs in my practice.
Yeah.
That are primary caretakers for the children.
So they're doing more than 5 hours a day?
So they're doing more than the definition of an au pair.
So maybe it's something that's being taken advantage of?
Possibly. Or maybe it's not as good a definition as it should be.
Maybe. Yeah. Still, I wouldn't say that excuses what she did.
No. And the fact that she was an au pair functioning as a nanny doesn't change things.
No. No, I think that if that was the understanding, she probably should have contacted the agency.
Right.
And gotten things fixed. Mm-hmm. She had been with another family previous to that where they had her working just as much, if not more.
Right. And the reason she left that was because it was too far out of Boston.
Right. So I think that maybe something was up with the au pair agency.
Yeah.
I don't think it's something the Eepins came up with on their own, that expectation. I think that she came with it.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Cece.
Hey, I got a letter from Melissa Holmes on Messenger. I absolutely love True Crime Brewery, and she's talking about the Lacey Spears, Munchausen by proxy, poisoned her son with sodium chloride. And as a mother, I cannot wrap my head around that monstrous act, but I really appreciate filling in the medical blanks for me. I want to suggest a case for you. And I've heard of this case. I think we both have.
Oh, okay.
I would love to hear your opinions, and especially from a pediatrician's point of view, on Mary Beth Tinning, who was accused of smothering 9 of her children, 1 adopted, all thought to be victims of SIDS.
I don't think I've heard of this.
Yeah, it was up in, I think, New York State or someplace. It's not too far.
Okay.
So it is. I remember reading about this, and there was a book written from Cradle to Grave by Joyce Eggington. A fascinating read. This woman basked in the attention she received when she was pregnant, and the same for the attention she got at the infant's funerals. Also, her husband seemed to completely check out and do nothing. Her behavior's mind-boggling. So, yeah, I think that's something we would like to look into.
Well, let's read the book.
Yeah.
Okay. On Amazon, I'll go through Ty Grabber and click on Shop Amazon and support Ty Grabber, and I'll buy that book. Okay. All right, so I have another one from CCCEO, but this one is about a daughter's deadly deception, the Jennifer Pan story, and it's a short one. She just says, I feel sorry for the girl. She didn't have a life other than what her parents wanted from her. She was obviously really good at what she enjoyed, so why couldn't she be accepted for that? So sure, I think that that's true, but still, very much like the case with Louise, that doesn't really excuse what she did.
No.
No.
So
Cece's very sympathetic to these young women, which I understand. Yeah, I don't think that tiger parenting is necessarily the best way to parent. I think that there needs to be more of an emotional connection with parents and kids, and it shouldn't be all based on what you can accomplish. Because she did seem like she could have been successful in life, and maybe that type of parenting led to this. But also, I think there was a real lack of empathy on her part.
Definitely. Yeah. There's no question in my mind.
Sure.
So I have Pink Stephanie on Facebook.
Okay.
I'm so excited you covered Jessica Ridgway. No one else has. I live 5 minutes away from her house. Volunteered to search for her. Wow. This is first person stuff.
Yeah.
And went to the vigil that was swarmed with undercover cops. They have since changed the name of the park her mom last saw her crossing to Jessica Ridgway Memorial Park. And changed everything to purple and green in her honor.
That's nice.
Every tree in the park is dedicated to someone, and each has a plaque for that. a heartbreaking crime, but I am so proud of my community for coming together in the aftermath. Oh, for sure.
It does sound like a nice thing the community did.
A wonderful tribute.
Yes. Really sad, though, isn't it?
It is.
So I've got a kind of lengthy email from Hayden, and this is about a daughter's deadly deception, the Jennifer Pan story. This is a recent case where we spoke to the author of the book, A Daughter's Deadly Deception. And I just found it interesting because it talks about some problems with the jury, like some bad behavior by the jury that could have had some kind of effect on the outcome of the case.
Really?
Yeah. So Hayden says, a guilty verdict was rendered in the Pan trial on December 13th, 2014, and on January 23rd, 2015 for the co-accused. They were sentenced to life in prison. Both events drew large crowds, and it became clear that the shadow of Juror 4's wife and her actions still lingered in the hallway, as many members of the public questioned whether the perception of a fair trial had been tarnished. So it was revealed in mid-July that Juror 4's wife, who actually kept this fact hidden and pretended simply to be a member of the public, had been texting information to her husband in the jury room, and he, in turn, shared these communications with other members of the jury. So the trial had started in March, and Juror 4's wife had attended almost every day. So the jury wrote a letter to the judge informing him of the situation and took the initiative to deem the information they received by the spouse as immaterial. Subsequently, a hearing was held in open court in which each member of the jury was placed in the witness box and questioned as to exactly what the information had been relayed. So it came out that the information involved pretty kind of petty issues that took place in the hallways concerning tardiness among lawyers and witnesses, that an upcoming witness had large breasts, petty stuff like that, except Juror 1 and Juror 2 revealed that they were aware of issues that had been dealt with in court when the jury wasn't present because of these texts. So the situation seemed to be diffused until it was further revealed that the wife had been very vocal in the hallways and was loudly expressing pro-Crown opinions and complimenting the police. So this is really interesting.
It is.
Juror 4 was again put on the witness stand in question, and he raised some eyebrows when he backtracked on specific questions regarding whether or not he was aware of any contact his wife may have had with other members of the jury. So after initially and immediately responding no, Juror 4 then corrected himself and stated that one juror lived near him and that they may have carpooled and had social gatherings together in their home. It appeared as though Juror 4 suddenly realized that the rest of the jury might also be questioned and that he'd be caught in a lie, so he modified his answer. So all defense counsel wanted Juror 4 dismissed from the jury, while the Crown, who initially took no position on the matter, later argued for him to remain on the basis that the matter was much ado about nothing. But the wife fiasco caused a buzz around the courthouse. How could the trial move forward fairly? Would a mistrial ensue? In the end, there was no mistrial, of course, and Juror 4 was not dismissed from the jury. But Justice Boswell banned Juror 4's wife from the courtroom. So as the trial continued, with many wondering if there was just too much at stake to declare a mistrial, the Pan trial was already into month 5, and it was supposed to be a 6-month trial. But as we know, it ended up being, what, 10 months?
10 months, yeah.
Yeah. The jurors were dismissed for a 3-week break after the judge's directions. They immediately hit the parking lot where they were seen smoking, socializing, and just hanging around as they often did, disregarding the judge's instructions. So jury conduct raised eyebrows at various times throughout the trial. During Jennifer Pan's direct examination, a message was relayed to the judge about the length of her testimony. So they stated that they were becoming anxious about how long her direct examination was taking. And after 6 months of Crown testimony, much of which was comprised of excruciatingly boring cell phone record testimony by phone expert, it seemed unconscionable that the jury was anxious after just 3 days of hearing what was, to all intents and purposes, the testimony of the star of the show. So as the months dragged along, the jury became used to asking for time off. Eventually, they began requesting time off on a weekly basis, and from September to the remainder of the trial, which ended in December, there was not one full week of sitting. They'd always had a day off. So members of the jury also returned to court in order to watch the co-accused go down for a mandatory life sentence, Juror 4 and his wife as well, and the jury foreman were among those who attended. The jury returned with a verdict in the Pan trial, and at around 1:20 p.m. the jury informed the justice that a verdict had been reached. Then at 2:45, about an hour and a half later, the court convened for the verdict. Many people expressed surprise that Jennifer Pan smiled and waved to the members as they left the courtroom. So because these messages seemed innocuous, it was decided that the trial would continue as normal. And in spite of this decision, Jennifer Pan and Eric Carty, they did seek a mistrial, but both were denied. This goes on. It's very lengthy. I'm not going to read the whole thing. But the balance of the defense counsel joined in a request that Juror 4 be discharged. There were also times when the police would come outside of the court and Juror 4's wife would be standing in the vestibule there and applaud them and tell them how great they'd done. And defense counsel also expressed concerns that Juror 4's spouse was sharing opinions with her husband, who he would be sharing them with the jurors that he sat with. So they did ban Juror 4's wife from attending the trial, but Juror 4 continued in the jury. So this was quite a hullabaloo.
Well, I guess it was, although when we read the book and interviewed Jeremy, there's no mention of jury misconduct or potential misconduct.
I know.
And he sat through the whole 10 months of trial.
Yeah, I sent him a message asking if he knew anything or had any opinions on this. And it seems pretty detailed, but I don't know if it's true, so an email I got, I'm looking for verification.
We'll see. But it seems to me that it's kind of a tempest in a teapot.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But I mean, some of these things could make a difference. If you're hanging out with people and you're making comments, it's not okay. He probably should have been removed from the jury if this is all true.
I'm not sure.
Okay. You just need to know more.
It would be good to know more, but I would figure that it was thoroughly investigated.
Hopefully.
And a decision was made.
It seems that way, yeah.
So.
It does.
It was, yeah. I mean, that's just something that came out of left field.
Yeah, you know? All right. Nothing that I'd heard about.
No. Okay, from Shauna Siegel on Facebook. I'm probably your biggest fan here in the Jerusalem area. Wow.
Yeah.
We've got Israelis listening to us.
I know.
Jerusalem was a fun place to visit.
Yes.
I have been a true crime buff since reading Helter Skelter in ninth grade, but have been getting into it more over the last 5 years, as it is one thing my husband and I can reliably enjoy together. As a registered nurse and a former history major, I have come to think that nothing is as fascinating as real human beings. Well, we share that opinion.
Yes.
Your podcast is deceptively homey and informal, but I like the fact that your approach is honest and not manipulative. Plus, the supportive and friendly banter between the two of you is an example of what we call in Hebrew good speech culture. If you're recording it, I will be listening. Consistently great job. Well, thank you, Shauna.
Yeah, I threw that in there because I just thought, Jerusalem, that's really amazing to me, someone that far away.
And yeah. But we've got people in Australia and Europe. I mean, we've got a big fan base.
That's the beauty of the internet, I guess. You can reach everywhere.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Who would have thought? I'll tell you some Jerusalem stories sometime. Not today.
Okay.
But anyway, thank you, Shauna. We appreciate that.
All right. Why don't you go ahead and do another one? It looks like you've got more of them there than I do.
Yeah. Who invited this up? I got one from Love Shack Shuckers Love on YouTube concerning a most selfish act, the Scott Peterson story.
Oh, that's always a good one to talk about. Yep.
Yeah. There's a thoroughly despicable human, as we said in the
absolutely.
The thing we just did.
Yep.
Why anyone doubts is beyond me. If he really was innocent and had nothing to do with her disappearance and death, he wouldn't have done half the shit he did. The nail was selling her vehicle, inquiring about selling the house. Only someone who knows she's dead and isn't coming back will do those things. It's not like she was missing for 7 years and was declared dead. She wasn't even missing a full month before he started to do things that screamed, she's not coming back.
For sure, yes.
He didn't want to be married. He didn't want kids. Instead of just getting a divorce, he thought he'd be charming enough to get away with it. He got away with so much, and his arrogance to this day leads him to think he'll win an appeal. This writer says, fat fucking chance.
Nice. Okay, well, I just have a quick little letter here, and it's from Lyndall, and it's titled, Good Day from Australia. Hi, Jill and Dick. I've spent the Easter break painting the house and listening to your podcasts that I have in bulk. I just haven't had time to listen. I find them very interesting, and I often find myself Googling the case to read more. The Australian case of William Tyrrell has affected Australians for sure. During the podcast, you make mention of our justice system, and you could not be more accurate. Australian law is way too lenient on criminals. It makes a lot of us Aussies outraged. Thank you for all you do. And P.S. to Dick, Foster's beer is definitely not an Aussie fave.
We know that.
Yeah, so it's funny. I do hear from a lot of people in Australia who think that their justice system is too lenient.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in some ways, I feel like they're more progressive than we are. But then in other ways, I can see, especially with the pedophiles, they did seem very lenient with pedophilia, like they maybe still think they can cure it. I don't know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a case we did in Australia.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, the one she mentioned, William Tyrrell. Yeah.
My turn again?
Yes.
Amanda on YouTube regarding the Casey Anthony story. So these are some interesting things. She says, I think AC could have possibly killed her daughter with Xanax while attempting to sedate her so that she could go party. Zanny the nanny. As far as the chloroform, this might have been in the month Kaylee was missing. Casey may have been trying to find a way and a place to dump her where she could make it look like a kidnap and homicide. All that is conjecture, of course. Now, this may sound grotesque, but as far as the duct tape goes, has anyone considered a theory that the duct tape was introduced into the situation because perhaps the body was obviously in the trunk, and not being around death before, Casey did not realize the odors that would begin to come from her orifices, and perhaps she put the duct tape on the child's mouth in an attempt to keep the smell from her gut from coming out. Then perhaps later the trash was placed to make an excuse for the scent. She may have kept the child in the trunk as long as she naively thought she could while she decided what to do with the body. She may have wrapped her in trash bags as well to keep the decomposition juices from getting into the interior of the car.
Well, it is grotesque, but it's a good point.
Yeah. I think if you're thinking that kind of rationally, that you don't want odors coming from her mouth, well, there's another orifice. So why didn't she duct tape the rectum also?
I don't know.
So I can't buy into that. I think the simple explanation that's probably the correct explanation is she sedated her and then put the duct tape on her when she was sedated so that she would stop breathing.
I think that's likely. I think it's also possible that the duct tape was to make it look like she'd been abducted or something and she had already been dead. But just the fact the duct tape was there makes it a murder, obviously.
Very sure.
Yeah.
No question.
So I have a little email from Avi, and it's a suggestion. It says, I'm a fan of your show, and as a Canadian, I really enjoyed your coverage of the Tim Basma murder. You mentioned your relative lack of awareness of the criminal goings in Canada, and I wanted to suggest that you cover the incredible true story of Colonel Russell Williams, the commander of the largest military airbase in Canada and an immensely respected and decorated member of Canada's armed forces, who also happened to be a psychopath, murderer, and rapist.
Wow. Yeah. That sounds good.
I'm reading this also because our daughter, Melissa, had said there was a Lifetime movie about this guy, and she'd recommended it as well. So this is our second.
So we have a Canadian and a non-Canadian recommending this.
We do. So let's do that episode, eh?
I think we have to look into that.
Yeah.
Because it's fascinating to me in kind of a macabre sense. But here's a guy who has a really important job, and he can manage to function day to day in that job. He's got people under his command. He's got all this stuff going, and he's nuts.
Yeah, very violent.
This is just fascinating to me.
Well, that always makes for the most fascinating cases when there's a dual life like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that's a definite.
Yeah. It's on our list, that's for sure.
Okay. We're still going.
A couple more.
Well, I'm the only one left.
You can give me one of them. I'll read one of them. Okay. So I'll read this one.
You read that one.
Okay. So this is an email. It's a it's an update on Little Boy Lost, Where is Dior Kuntz? From Mary in Delaware. So it says, EastIdahoNews.com has received a large number of emails and phone calls regarding the remains found in Elmore County and the possibility that they are the remains of Dior Kuntz Jr. Local media reached out to the sheriff's office and asked for a direct answer. There is no way the remains could be that of Dior Kuntz, Elmore County Under Sheriff Greg Berry told EastIdahoNews.com. Absolutely not possible. These bones have been in the desert a lot longer than that. The undersheriff went on to say that the preliminary estimates are putting the remains in the desert at between 15 and 20 years old. The remains of a toddler found near Mountain Home were tested to determine the age of the child. Elmore County Sheriff Mike Hollinshead told East Idaho News the child was between 1 and 5 years old and was originally buried in the ground, but a badger recently dug up the remains. So the remains were discovered by Idaho Fish and Game employees working in the area. One of the employees saw the bones and later discovered a human skull. They have not ruled out criminal activity and are treating the remains as they would in any homicide investigation. The information indicates that the body has been there for quite some time. It appears, though, to have been buried for longer than 10 years. So it's not Dior.
Yeah, so neither of those fit Dior.
No. Thank you, Mary.
Okay, I still got a couple more.
Okay.
I forgot this one. This is Joan from Massachusetts, and this is regarding to a case we did a long time ago. What happened to Ayla Reynolds?
Yeah.
I mean, that was one of our early ones.
Yes, it was.
So Joan says, that poor little girl. Police know full well that those three who were with her the night she disappeared know what happened. But if any of them were charged, they would just blame the others. And there's no physical proof of who did what, so conviction would be unlikely. It seems that a civil suit would be the only way to hold them accountable, but it will be a hollow victory. I'll bet none of them are even worried about it because you can't get something from someone who has nothing. I think the only hope is that one day one of them develops a conscience or gets really angry at the main perpetrator and rats Justin DiPietro out.
That's the father.
That's the father of Ayla. So I think Joan and you and I are all on the same wavelength.
I think so.
It's very apparent that the father and his sister, right, and mother, but the family members are involved in the murder.
They did find blood in the basement.
There's a ton of evidence that suggests that she was murdered.
But it's been years now and nothing's being done.
Yeah,
it's been 6 years almost.
I can see what Joan says, that they can't charge somebody.
No, they really can't. Although...
you'd like that.
I'd like to. I feel like the father should be charged. I feel like he should at least be charged with child neglect or something.
Anything.
Yeah.
Not going to happen, probably.
Probably not. Okay, and then I think you have one more.
Last one. This is from Matt King on Facebook, and this is on the abduction of Jessica Ridgway. On the Monster in the Neighborhood episode, you said there's 750,000 abductions a year. Where did that number come from? And did you bother to do any division to see what that number breaks down to? Because it seems incredibly high.
Sure does.
I know. I thought about it too. But here's where it comes from.
Okay.
This was from several years ago. Over 840,000 people, adults and children, reported missing to the FBI's National Crime Information Center. It's real. Now, the FBI estimates that 85 to 90% of these, which is roughly 750,000 people that were reported missing, were children.
Okay.
Okay, so that's where it comes from.
So that includes parental abductions. That's everything.
That's everything.
Okay.
So I guess the number that stands up is the 840,000.
In a year? Is this based in a year?
In 2001.
Wow, that does seem huge.
It does. Now, the estimate is that 85 to 90% were kids, so that might be open to interpretation.
Sure.
But the number that was actually reported is 840,000.
Okay, and it's a very small percentage of that, then, that's a stranger abduction or a homicide.
No, that's not what they were saying. They're just saying that 85 to 90% were children.
Right.
They don't break those down.
Right, but it would be a very small percent of those children that were kidnapped by someone who was a stranger and murdered them.
Right.
That's what I'm saying.
We covered that.
Okay.
In the abductions.
Yes. Okay.
Matt King just wanted to know where we got that number.
Okay, but what division did he want you to do?
I think he wanted me to break it down into ages.
And you're not going to do that.
Well, I don't have the numbers for that.
Okay. All right. All right. So, Matt, if you want to do that footwork and let us know, break it down. We're open to that, but so Dick's not going to do it.
Well, I'm just going by what I read from the National Crime Information Center, NCIC.
Right. But you did read other statistics.
Well, I read other statistics in terms of family kidnapping, acquaintance kidnapping, and stranger kidnapping.
Right, so that would kind of break it down if you looked at it that way.
If you do it that way.
Yeah, so that's available on the internet, sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
But we talked about that.
All right.
Okay.
Yes, very good.
Over and out.
All right, thank you, Dick.
Thank you, Jill.
All right, we'll talk to everybody later.
We will.
Okay, take care.
See you next time.
See you at the quiet end.